This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Today is Monday, April the 29th. I will be reading for you today the USA Today newspaper, second hour, which contains the opinion and the money sections. I will start today with the opinion sections. There are two of them. The first one is entitled, New Trial for Weinstein, The Right Call, by Kara Pearson, USA Today. American phones buzzed Thursday morning with news alerts about a shocking decision in a case that helped fuel the Me Too movement and changed U.S. history. A New York Court of Appeals overturned film producer Harvey Weinstein's 2020 conviction and 23-year sentence for sexual crimes against three women. The judges ordered a new trial, and Weinstein will remain in prison while serving a 16-year sentence for rape in a separate case. In its opinion, the appeals court lambasted the trial court for having erroneously admitted testimony of uncharged alleged prior sexual acts against persons other than the complainants of the underlying crimes. Because that testimony served no material non-propensity purpose. The court's opinion also said Weinstein's case was further prejudiced when he was cross-examined about the witness's testimony, which undermined his rights to testify and bolstered the women's testimony while also portraying him in a highly prejudicial light. The decision is an enormous disappointment for advocates and victims of sexual violence. But for lawyers, the ruling is not a major surprise. The stakes were too high for the prosecution and the judge to take such big risk and make such big mistakes. They should have known better. It may seem logical that if so many women and stories about Harvey Weinstein's sexual abuse or harassment, then no story should be heard in a case where he faced charges for the same type of conduct. Nonetheless, our evidence laws are not always logical. Often, they are policy-based. That is especially true of character evidence. And the New York rules of evidence are clear and specific about when and how evidence of a defendant's character is admissible. Even when character evidence may be permitted under one of the Molinet exceptions, which the prosecutor tried to use during trial, the court must use discretion to weigh the value of that testimony versus the prejudicial effect it will have on the defendant. A right to be held to account only for the crime charged. In the common law system, which is based on legal precedent, one court's decision can have far-reaching consequences. The appellate court made clear that its ruling was based on upholding the foundations of our criminal justice systems in the opening paragraph, which states, under our system of justice, the accused has a right to be held to account only for the crime charged, and thus allegations of prior bad acts may not be admitted against them for the sole purpose of establishing their propensity for criminality. It is our solemn duty to diligently guard these rights regardless of the crime charged, the reputation of the accused, or the pressure to convict. In general, we don't want a court system that conflicts people based on testimony about allegations they haven't been charged with. It's easy to imagine all the ways that kind of an evidentiary rule could be abused, and it's too great of a risk to take. The main takeaway from the court's decision on Thursdays aren't really about Weinstein or even his victims. The New York ruling is much bigger than that. It's about the importance of following the letter of the law, safeguarding our constitutional right to a fair trial and the right to present a defense, no matter who the accused is or how gregarious their alleged crimes are. Yet it's also about the chilling effect that this case will have on future victims of sexual violence. I worry about the aftermath for victims of sexual violence. The consequences of what happened in the trial court makes things that much harder for future victims of sexual violence to come forward to authorities. If victims have to go through the trauma of reliving their experiences and the stress and massive comment of criminal trial, only to have their aggressor's conviction overturned, and then be forced either to watch the accused go free or go through the trial process again, then why come forward in the first place? The rule of law won Thursday, and as much as I am unhappy to see a convicted rapist get a new trial, and as much as I worry about the aftermath for victims of sexual violence, I know that it was the right decision for democracy's sake. This is written by Carrie Pearson. She is a digital editor at USA Today and a New York licensed attorney. The next article is entitled, Flint Water Crisis Still Hurts 10 Years Later. A decade later, I still can't say I really understand what happened in Flint or why it happened at all. What I come back to again and again, though, is the lying. This is by Nancy Kaffer, Detroit Free Press. By 2015, I had been a reporter for a decade and a half, but I had never been lied to like I was after the water crisis story broke in Flint, Michigan. Most journalists in Detroit and Lansing, the largest concentration of reporters in the state, followed Flint only sporadically. I had written about the Genesee County Drain Commissioner's flawed plan to create a new regional water authority, a plan developed mostly because for reasons that still bear interrogation. The commissioner intended to cut out the Detroit Water and Sewage Department, and I wrote about some of the problems that followed the switch, after some bacterial outbreaks suggested things weren't going smoothly. In Detroit, our attention to the summer of 2015 was largely consumed with the ongoing aftermath of the 2013 municipal bankruptcy filing, the early days of the 2016 presidential campaign, and shamefully, the latest Lansing scandal, an extramarital affair between two state lawmakers whose names few even remember. While most of Michigan wasn't paying attention, Flint's state-appointed emergency manager had signed on to the new water authority and okayed a switch to Flint River water while the new system was under construction. That happened in 2014. By that October, General Motors stopped using Flint River water in its plants there, saying it was too corrosive. Residents reported that the city's tap water was yellow, smelled and tasted bad, but the state insisted the water test showed everything was fine. Blood lead levels of children in Flint had elevated. Then I got a call from a longtime source who wanted to introduce me to Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha, a local pediatrician and a researcher who had some explosive news. Since the water switch, the blood lead levels of children in Flint had elevated, proof positive that thousands of young children had been exposed to a neurotoxin. I remember the surrealism of that phone call. When you get the first line on a big story, you wonder if you're about to feel the fool, because what you thought you just heard is too terrible to be true. Well, it was true, and the next year was powerful and frustrating in near equal measure. Powerful because of the effects of brave Flint residents to tell the truth about the endpoint of absolute systematic failure, and because of the reporting undertaken by a handful of dedicated journalists at a slew of statewide organizations. I'll never forget meeting Flint moms struggling to care for their children without tap water, or their anger and frustration at the disregard they had been subjected to, or kids whose futures might be shaped by circumstances that they were too young to understand. Some of those children remind me of my son, then 5. I had to not think about that part too much. Frustrating because the failures that led to the Flint water crisis were all too clear, and none of it needed to happen. Frustrating because of the lying. State officials repeatedly tried to discredit the Flint residents. People sometimes suggest that politicians and their responsibilities lie often, but with a notable exception or two, they don't. Sure, politicians stretch the truth, shade things to flatter themselves and their interests, but to lie outright is rare, in no small part because it's just too easy to get caught. Moral obligations aside, it's just not worth it. However, Flint was different. As the water crisis unfolded, state officials repeatedly tried to discredit the Flint residents who wouldn't stop sounding the alarm, suggesting they were angling for new fixtures or plumbing repairs on the city or the state dime. They attacked Hannah Altisha, the pediatrician researcher whose medical center was a regional catchment for blood lead level testing in small children, and who went public with what she had learned. A state spokeswoman described a U.S. Environmental Protection Agency water expert as a rogue employee and a Virginia Tech scientist as some sort of flim-flam artist. Hannah Altisha's data, the press secretary of then-Governor Rick Snyder wrote in an email to me on September 24th of 15, was spliced and diced. State officials took great pains to suggest that the decision to switch to Flint River water was made by the local elected officials who had been displaced by the appointment of an emergency manager, adopting the bizarre pretense that state-appointed emergency managers granted sweeping unilateral authority by state law were ineffectively rubber-stamping of local decision-making. The state, the spokeswoman wrote, had severe reservations about the water switch, signing off only at the behest of the Flint City Council. Flint's council did endorse the switch, but state law grants emergency managers absolute authority, and emergency managers are appointed because state officials don't think the local elected leaders have made very good decisions. That part about severe reservations was simply untrue. Emails revealed after the crisis broke made it plain that state officials were fine with the switch, even in the face of evidence suggesting it would cost more to use the river water. What did their own data say? A few days after that September 24th email from Snyder's press secretary, the Detroit Free Press obtained data intended to refute Hannah Atisha's claims, showing that kids' blood lead levels were fine. There was, if you're not a math person, a very convincing chart. Presumably, they hoped we'd republish it and the world would see what the state wanted them to. And it might have worked, but for Free Press data reporter Christy Tanner. Tanner, also a professor, requested additional numbers performing her own analysis and determined that state's own data supported Hannah Altisha's research. That's what covered the Flint water crisis was like, scrambling around to establish the fact of things that were partly true the whole time. The water was contaminated with lead. Flint residents were harmed. The state and its emergency managers were at fault. The state's effort to discredit the truth tellers and to dodge blame displayed a diligence that didn't seem present in their duty of care for Flint. I cry when I'm angry, so I cried a lot that fall. The state eventually got straight on the need to acknowledge that there was a serious problem. A fatal outbreak of Legionnaires' disease led to the criminal charges against some state officials, but didn't result in conviction of the highest-ranking members of state government, including Snyder. Flint received funding to replace its lead service lines, and the city's water has met state and federal safety for years now. But money can't fix a broken trust. It's not so easy to repair the toll on Flint's residents. Some may never trust tap water again or the government. And who can blame them? The city and state opted not to treat the drinking water with an affordable mixture of chemicals called corrosion control that would have kept lead out of the water. For 16 months, state government lied to Flint, insisting the yellow, foul-tasting water coming out of residents' taps was fine. A state-appointed manager waved off residents' concerns with the underlying assumption they were compelled by some sinister motivation. A decade later, I still can't say I really understand what happened in Flint or why it happened at all. What I come back to again and again, though, is the lying. The water crisis didn't have to happen. But after it did, they didn't have to lie about it. Nancy Kaffer is an editorial page editor of the Detroit Free Press, where this column originally was published. If you want more information, you can contact her at nkaffer@freepress.com. That concludes the two sections of opinion. I will now move to the money section of USA Today for Monday, April the 29th. The first article is entitled, Credit Scores Take a Hit When the Spouse Dies. One of the worst things that can happen to your credit score, research shows, is the death of your spouse. Emotional toll of a partner's death is devastating, of course, but once the initial shock of the loss subsides, the financial challenges of living alone cannot be ignored. When an older American dies, the credit score of a surviving partner takes a hit, and the lower credit can haunt the survivor for up to 2 years. The study from researchers at Ohio State University underscore the financial turmoil that often follows the death of a spouse. Some financial fallout from a partner's death is obvious and well documented. Loss of income from work, Social Security, or a pension benefit. But survivors face many other financial burdens, keeping up with monthly bills, tracking down account numbers and passwords, gaining access to accounts held in the dead partner's name, and dealing with the partner's debt. Those tasks can bog down, leading to missed payments and lower credit scores. And everything gets much harder, researchers say, when the surviving partner was not the one paying the bills. Husbands are more likely to pay the household bills. Survivors face that predicament more often than you might think, researchers say. Blame gender roles and longevity tables. You're much more likely to have your male partner die before your female partner, and often the male partner was the one paying the bills, said Stephanie Moulton, a professor of public policy at Ohio State and co-author of the recent paper. Moulton and her colleagues set out to study the financial setbacks that followed the death of partners over age 50 in the pandemic, which widowed hundreds of thousands of older Americans. They found that surviving partners saw their credit score drop by 10 points on average, on a scale that ranged from 300 to 850 points. Their findings, published last fall as part of the Social Security Administration's Retirement and Disability Research Consortium, found a wider audience this month in a blog post from the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. Even a small drop in credit scores can cause headaches. A 10-point drop in a credit score isn't such a big deal, but many survivors suffer larger drops, and even a small one can cause a headache. Someone seeking a conventional fixed-rate 30-year home mortgage, for example, typically needs a credit score of 620. If your score dips to 610 or 600, you may not qualify for the loan. The study also found surviving partners were more likely to fall behind on bills, triggering late fees and debt collection, all potentially damaging to credit scores. Several economic factors feed the credit woes of widowed Americans. One is diminished income, a loss that one 2020 research paper estimated at $5,500 per year for the surviving partner. Another is the stress and anxiety around a partner's death, which can leave the survivor feeling overwhelmed. Older adults who lose a partner face a higher poverty rate than those who are still married, according to research from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. A lot of the bills don't get cut in half. The death of a partner cuts some expenses dramatically. Think groceries, plane fares, healthcare costs. Other costs stay pretty much the same, including mortgage and car loan payments. A lot of the bills don't get cut in half, and so that pinches your income, Moulton said. And then there's the matter of tracking down all the bills. American women outlive men by nearly 6 years. But men pay the bills in most older households, researchers said. When a husband dies, a female partner may be forced to take over the family finances without any real preparation. If the husband's name and email address is on every account, the survivor could find it difficult even to access the account, let alone pay the bills. Automatic bill payments, a convenience of the online era, can wreak havoc on a widow, especially when the money is being drawn from an account that belonged to the deceased partner and is losing value. Widows may find themselves hounded by creditors, sometimes for debts they are not obliged to pay. Widows don't often realize that if there is a credit card that is only in the husband's name, and there are no assets in the estate, they are not responsible for that debt, said Jessica Johnson, senior director of the Center for Benefits Excess of the National Council on Aging. Fortunately, couples can take steps now to prepare for the unexpected death of the family bill payer. Here are some expert tips. Add your spouse to your accounts. A spouse who pays the bills can contact the companies and add a partner to the account as a joint account holder or authorized user. Make sure your spouse is named as a beneficiary on investment accounts or in insurance policies. You would be shocked at the number of people who forget to change beneficiaries or just don't put beneficiaries at all on retirement or investment accounts, Johnson said. Make a monthly bill file. Print out monthly statements for every bill, documents that show account numbers, phone numbers, mailing addresses, and monthly payments. Put them in a file. Include some sort of letter that explains who the various contacts are and what all the assets are, said Chester Splatt, a professor of finance at Carnegie Mellon. That file can also include a power of attorney form for financial matters, said Evan Potash, a wealth management advisor at TIAA, the financial services nonprofit. If you have a will, include that too. Pay the bills together. This may not sound like much of a date night, but consider sitting down with your partner and walking them through the monthly routine of bill paying. It doesn't have to be painful, Moulton said. It can be a way to establish some independence. Meet as a couple with your financial planner. In many couples, one partner handles all the meetings with a financial planner or investment advisor. Consider bringing the other partner along. I always encourage my clients to bring their spouse, Potash said. Together with the advisor, the couple can review the family finances and take steps to make sure either partner is prepared to manage them. The next article is entitled, New FA-FSA Rules to Help Give 529 Plans Needed Boost. The 529 Education Savings Plan got a couple of big upgrades in 24 as a tool to save and pay for school. Starting this year, Congress is allowing up to $35,000 in leftover savings in the plan to roll over tax-free into Roth individual retirement accounts, eliminating fears unused money could forever be trapped or incur taxes. Then, at the end of December, the Department of Education revised the free application for federal student aid, FAFSA, creating the so-called grandparent loophole. The grandparent loophole allows grandparents to use a 529 plan to fund a grandchild's education without affecting the student's financial aid eligibility. Previously, withdrawals could have reduced aid eligibility by up to 50% of the amount of the distribution. A $10,000 distribution from a grandparent-owned 529 may reduce the following aid allowed by $5,000 under prior rules, wrote William Cass, Director of Wealth Management Programs for Boston, Bays Management. What is the grandparent loophole? Well, beginning with the new 2425 FAFSA launched late last year, a student's total income is only based on data from federal income tax returns. That means any cash support, no matter the source, won't negatively affect financial aid eligibility. Though it's called the grandparent loophole, any non-parent, including friends and relatives, can use it. Previously, distributions from any non-parent-owned 529 plan were included as untaxed student income, which reduced eligibility for need-based aid. To avoid this, people got crafty with timing distributions. Since the prior FAFSA wasn't based on financial information going back 2 years, people waited until the last 2 years of college before tapping non-parent 529s to minimize the negative effect withdrawals would have as income. Since the new FAFSA doesn't count any of these distributions as income, no one need to worry about any of this anymore, said Teresa Scarlotta, Head of Education Savings at J.P. Morgan Asset Management. Other advantages of the 529 plan. The grandparent loophole and Roth IRA rollovers are just the latest benefits added to the 529 plan, what Scarlotta says is her favorite education savings plan. It's the plan you can contribute the most amount, get tax-free growth, and withdrawal and some in-state tax benefits, she said. Other advantages include contributions aren't tax-free for a federal basis, but withdrawals are tax-free for qualified expenses like tuition and fees. Books and other supplies are up to $10,000 annually for K-12 tuition. Most states will give you a tax break for contributions if you invest in your state's 529 plan. Check your state's rules. A handful of states offer tax parity, which means you can deduct at least some of your contributions to any plan in the United States, not just the one provided by your state. Contributions are considered gifts. For 2024, the annual gift limit is $18,000 for an individual, $36,000 for a married couple, so you can contribute up to that amount in a 529 without incurring the IRS gift tax. That amount is per beneficiary, so parents, grandparents, and others may gift as much annually to each student. Accelerated gifting allows you up to 5 years of gifting and a 529 in one lump sum of $90,000 for an individual or $180,000 for a couple, if you can afford it. This allows the full amount of growth tax-free longer. You can invest contributions and allow the balance to grow tax-free despite this benefit, Scarlotta said. About half of Americans keep their money in cash and cash equivalents like certificates of deposit, CDs, or savings accounts. With college tuition rising about 8% annually, keeping those types of assets in your 529 isn't going to help you pay for college, she said. The broad market S&P 500 stock index, on the other hand, returns 10% annually on average, giving you a shot at ramping up your savings. The next article is entitled, Not All Issues on a Boeing Equal. Experts say while its practices deserve scrutiny, planes are safe. Not all issues involving Boeings are created equal. Boeing has been in the news a lot lately, and that's partly because of me. As an aviation reporter, it's my job to follow what's going on at the company and update the public about any important developments. Where it gets a little muddier, though, is when some incidents involving a Boeing airplane that is not specifically a Boeing issue caps intentional. As a result of some very high-profile and serious safety incidents, Boeing is rightfully under a microscope now. But just because there's a news appetite for it doesn't mean that Boeing is responsible for everything that goes on with its aircraft once they leave the factory floor. At a time when people are thinking about the planes they fly on more than usual, it can be hard to highlight relevant information without misleading readers into thinking there's more a malfeasance than there actually is. It's a newsroom conversation every time we see Boeing bubbling in news trends. My job is to hold Boeing accountable without fear-mongering. Aviation professionals agree that while Boeing and its practices deserve scrutiny, you should still feel free all right flying on its planes. So let's try to cut through the noise. What's going on at Boeing is distinctively separate from the types of issues that happen in service. That, by the way, would largely go unnoticed or unreported on if it wasn't what happened on an Alaska 1282. There are genuine worries about Boeing in terms of its performance as a company and safety cultures, its manufacturing culture, John Osterroe, editor-in-chief of the Air Current, told me. It's hard to boil down the problems of Boeing because they didn't happen overnight. They're systematic and the result of a series of small charges and corporate decisions often dictate that de-emphasize engineering excellence and safety and put extra importance on shareholder returns. But that's not the only thing. During COVID, we had a lot of retirement that happened both on the pilot front and the mechanic front, that there was a lot of senior expertise that left. Laura Garreau, a civil engineering professor specializing in aviation at Georgia Tech, told me, the senior expertise probably provided a series of checks and balances that are being relearned and reinstitutionalized in some companies. Garreau is on a consulting contract with Boeing on unrelated issues. She said her perspective applies to not just Boeing, but the aviation industry as a whole. According to Osterrover, Boeing needs to change its corporate culture to emerge from the current shadow. Boeing's behavior in terms of the design of the 737 MAX is an aberration in an otherwise phenomenal safe system, he said. We need to put themselves back together, and I mean that quite literally. There has been an internal breakup of the company over decades that has fractured their workforce, both the engineers and the machinists, spiritually and geographically. Boeing is, of course, under investigation by federal regulators as a result of these issues. It's unclear what the outcome of those investigations would be, but it seems likely some internal company changes will be required. What airplane issues is Boeing responsible for? What's going on at Boeing is distinctively separate from the types of issues that happen in service. That, by the way, would largely go unnoticed if unreported by the Alaska 1282. She said another way, a Boeing plane may be involved in an incident that has nothing to do with Boeing itself. There is a pile-on fixation that happens in the broader media landscape. That is a function of how people are feeling about their confidence in Boeing, but it is fundamentally is not related to anything that's been going on at Boeing. Garrow pointed out that aviation is extremely safe overall and has only gotten safer over time. A lot of the safety features have redundancies. A lot of the kinks have been worked out, she said. Not every aircraft flies perfectly. There are maintenance issues that happen, but they are getting increased scrutiny right now. Of course, Boeing is responsible for manufacturing defects like the missing bolts that led to the Alaska Airlines explosive decompression earlier this year. But as an airframer, Boeing doesn't manufacture things like engines. Those are supplied by other companies or places the tires on planes that have been in service for many years. Once an aircraft is away from the factory, airlines largely take over its maintenance. If a flight is delayed because of a problem, it's because someone has noticed it and it is being addressed. That's the system working. These are incredibly complex machines, and they run at a reliability level that is truly extraordinary. There are levels of redundancy. You can defer maintenance in items in a safe and well-understood way. This component wasn't active on my airplane, and that's fine. You can operate safely with that. It's approved to do that. What is an emergency landing? Another gray area when it comes to the news is emergency landings. A casual traveler understandably hears the word emergency and thinks of the absolute worst case. Still, the Federal Aviation Administration allows and in fact encourages pilots to declare an emergency in any distress or urgency condition. According to the Pilot Controller Glossary, that can include a condition of being concerned about safety and of requiring timely but not immediate assistance. Aviation safety is built on redundancy and over-caution, so a pilot declaring an emergency is usually another sign that the system is working as designed. It doesn't always bear being reported on. Are Boeing airplanes safe? The short answer is yes. Trust has been broken at Boeing, and the airlines are paying for that. It makes it really hard for us to say, trust the airlines and their processes, but you have to because there's ample evidence and ample history and safety culture to back that up. Thousands of Boeing aircrafts fly without incident every day. Eventually, the company's place at the top of the news cycle will fade, though the focus on safety throughout aviation will remain as it always has. People shouldn't have to think about that kind of airplane they're getting on, and we need to get back to that. The way we're going to get back to that is through getting not just Boeing, but the airlines on a reliable footing. In the meantime, the author said, travelers should consider the bigger picture. The few times an aircraft has gone down, there has been a major accident. I personally have found it was very difficult the next day to get on a flight if I'm traveling. Aviation has one of the best safety records of all of the modes, and I personally don't want to change my life and not go on my dream vacation to Europe or not go on my professional trip that I literally could not drive to because of a fear of flying, she said. I just always remind myself that aviation has had one of the best safety records, and I'm comforted by the fact that I'm not driving the plane, that I have two experienced pilots that have been trained for multiple safety scenarios, and I'm in good hands when I travel. Okay, another article under the money section is consumer prices continue to increase. A key inflation measure rose sharply in March, further dampening hopes that the Federal Reserve will soon cut interest rates. An underlying gauge of price increases stayed elevated, and household spending increased dramatically again, possibly keeping inflation higher for longer. Consumer prices overall increased 2.7% from a year earlier, above February's 2.5% rise, but well below the 40-year high of 7% in June of 22, according to the Commerce Department. On a monthly basis, prices increased 0.3% in line with the advance the prior month, the PCE index showed. What is the current core PCE inflation rate? A measure of core prices that excludes volatile food and energy items and that the Feds follow more closely increased 0.3% on a monthly basis, the same as in February. That kept the annual increase at 2.8%. The disappointing readings were largely expected after the Commerce Department said in Thursday's report on economic growth that core PCE inflation rose at an annual rate of 3.7% in the first quarter, more than 3.4% forecasters had projected. The big gain was mostly the result of an upward revision to January's monthly increase to 0.5% from 0.45%, said economist Paul Ashworth of Capital Economics. Just a few weeks ago, Federal Chair Jerome Powell said the central bank would not overreact to worrisome inflation numbers in January and February. He suggested they could have been blimped and inflation still appeared headed towards the Fed's 2% target. His tone changed, however, after another inflation measure out this month, the Consumer Price Index, related larger than expected gains in March. Overall, inflation jumped to 3.5% from 3.2%, and the core reading stayed high at 3.8%. Economists were hoping the PCE figures would provide some solace because they've been running well below CPI, and rent, which has been leaping steadily, has half the weight of the PCE index that it holds in PCI. The Feds also tend to watch PCE more closely. What's the market doing today? Despite the high annual inflation readings, investors largely took Friday's report in stride. That's because the 0.3% monthly gain in overall and core prices was largely in line with expectations. In early trading, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 86 points to 38.171, and the S&P 500 was up 0.8%. Is inflation expected to go down? The price of goods such as used cars, furniture, and appliances generally have fallen as pandemic-related supply chain snarls have resolved. But the cost of services, including rent, car insurance, and health care, have climbed higher, in part because of sharply rising wages tied to COVID-19-induced labor shortages. Last month, good prices ticked up just 0.1% as the cost of vehicles and parts tumbled 0.6%, but the cost of services jumped 0.6%. Transportation surged 1.6%, and financial services and insurances increased by 0.5%. Is the Fed going to lower the interest rates in 24? After the PCI report, Powell said it's likely to take longer than expected for the Feds to gain confidence that inflation is heading substantially to the Fed's target. Future markets that had anticipated the first decrease of the Fed's key interest rate in June and a total of three cuts this year now expected just one. They now just expect one in September. Here's an interesting, it's called Don't Visit These National Parks Without a Reservation This Summer. Every year, it seems that more national parks are requiring timed entry reservations. Sometimes it's just to drive into a park. Other times it's for specific sought-after activities. This summer is no different. With Mount Rainier and Yosemite joining the mix, the requirements add an extra step and expense for travelers, but they're not meant to be a hurdle. The timed entry system reservation system is not to limit visitation, but to spread it out more equitably throughout the day, Mount Rainier National Park Ranger Terry Wildley told USA Today. In the past, she said, visitors had to wait up to 3 hours just to enter the popular park, and some caused lasting damage to meadows when venturing off the trails to avoid crowds. As Mount Rainier rolls out reservations this summer, here's what other park visitors should know. How many national parks have timed entry? Only a fraction of America's 63 national parks require timed entry reservations or permits for particular popular experiences. In most cases, they're only for certain portions of the park during the busiest times of the day. Acadia National Park will require timed entry reservations for vehicle access to Cadillac Summit Road from May the 24th through October the 22nd. There are two types of reservations, sunrise and daytime, with varying restrictions. Each reservation costs $6 per vehicle and may only be purchased online, not in the park. A separate $35 vehicle entry fee is also required for the park. Arches National Park requires timed entry reservations for all vehicles entering the park between 7 a.m. and 4 p.m. through October the 31st. Timed entry tickets cost $2. A separate vehicle entry fee of $30 is also required. Glacier National Park will require timed entry reservations for vehicles accessing North Fork, and going to the Sun Road from the west entrance between 6 a.m. and 3 p.m. from May the 24th through September the 8th. Reservations will not be required for vehicles entering Going to the Sun Road from the St. Mary's entrance, nor will they be required for Two Medicine like they were last year. However, they will still be required for Mini Glacier between 6 a.m. and 3 p.m. from July 1st through September the 8th. Each type of reservation costs $2. A separate $35 vehicle entry fee is also required for the park. Halikia National Park requires reservations year-round for visitors who want to watch sunrise from the summit. Summit sunrise reservations cost $1 and are required for every vehicle entering the park between 3 a.m. and 7 a.m. A separate $30 vehicle entry fee is also required for the park. Mount Rainier National Park, for the first time, will require timed entry reservations for two of its most popular areas, Paradise Quarter from May 24th through September 2nd, and Sunrise Quarter between July 3rd and September the 2nd. Reservations will only be needed between 7 a.m. and 3 p.m. Each type of reservation will cost $2, and a separate $30 vehicle entry fee is also required. Rocky Mountain National Park will require timed entry reservations to access most roads between 9 and 2 from May through October. Visitors who also want to access the park, Busy Bear Lake Road, will need a specific type of reservation. timed entry plus between 5 and 6 from May through October. Shenandoah National Park requires day use tickets to hike Old Rag Mountain through November 30th. Tickets cost $2 per person and can be reserved 30 to 5 days in advance. The day use tickets are separate from the park's $30 vehicle entry fee. Yosemite National Park now requires reservations for vehicles entering the park between 5 and 4. But they'll be required every day from July 1st through August 16th. Peak hour reservations cost $2 on top of the $35 vehicle fee. Zion National Park is continuing to pilot its permit system for its popular Angel's Landing hiking trail. Permits can be obtained through a seasonal lottery or day lottery on recreational.gov. Lottery reservations cost $6 for up to 6 people for each lottery. Permits cost $3 per person. That's on top of the $35 vehicle entry fee for the park. So it sounds like it's going to be kind of expensive this year to attend some national parks. Okay. I am now going to go to, that concludes most of the money section area of the USA Today. I'm going to go to the 50 states section. We have about 5 minutes left of this hour. Okay, let me go to Anchorage, Alaska. One climber is dead and another climber is injured after a 1,000-foot fall off a mountain at Denali National Park, which wasn't one of the parks that was mentioned in the previous article. Prescott, Arizona. State authorities have made an arrest in a case where a man is accused of housing 40 venomous reptiles in his Prescott home. All 36 snakes, which were illegal to possess, were euthanized due to fungal disease. In Sacramento, California, state wildlife commissioners have broadened protection for a native Southern California fish on the brink of extinction. Here in Denver, Colorado, a Colorado judge sentenced paramedic Jeremy Cooper to probation and work release, closing out the last of 3 trials around the 2019 death of unarmed black man Elijah McClain. Okay, in Wilmington, Delaware. Delaware House of Representatives passed a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. The resolution also called for the release of hostages held in Israel's war with Hamas. The delivery of sustained humanitarian aid in the ravaged territory, as well as diplomatic actions to bring about long-term and mutual respected peace in the region. In Titusville, Florida, a high-tech drone hovered above the Indian River Lagoon to spread cluster bombs of tiny baby super clams to seed a natural defense of an estuary that's been under ecological attacks for decades. Friday's drone deployment was part of the Indian River Lagoon Billion Clam Initiative, spearheaded by the Coastal Conservation Association of Florida, a nonprofit sports fishing and marine advocacy group. That was interesting. Okay, here's one in Hawaii, in Honolulu. Hawaii's House and state leaders hammered out an agreement on the draft of the state budget bill costing $19.2 billion for the fiscal year 24-25 last week. But lawmakers are racing against the clock to pass critical legislation, including the ongoing cost of Maui's wildfire response and how to best tackle AI-generated political ads by Friday. Nearly 300 bills remain in conference committees, with less than half receiving hearings. Okay, I will go one closer to home. Bloomington, Indiana, a whistleblower and former safety chief at a southern Indiana military installation said since he filed a report warning of potential dangerous safety lapses, the U.S. Army and Navy have retaliated against him and are torpedoing his career. In Louisville, Kentucky, the high-profile murder trial of Bardstown mother Crystal Rogers may be held next year in southwestern Kentucky if the Nelson Circuit Court Judge Charles Sims agrees with a tentative proposal one defense attorney in the case says was reached with prosecutors. Not familiar with that case. In Detroit, Michigan, the CEO of a cannabis testing company with a lab in Michigan said substances that could be harmful to consumers have been found in cannabis oil used in edibles and vape pens, and has called out marijuana companies for not disclosing they are using them. And let's see if we can find one from Ohio. Don't see one from Ohio. Okay, we'll go Pennsylvania then. Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. In Pennsylvania, roughly $1.8 billion in medical debt sits in collection, saddling people who have experienced health problems and sometimes stopping them from paying for housing, food, and care. Governor Josh Shapiro is pushing a plan to dedicate $4 million in state funding to wipe out an estimated $400 million of that debt. Okay, that includes all the time we have today, Monday, April 29th, for the second hour. This is Bill. I'll be signing off. You have a great week.